I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
I take full responsibility for my actions. I have been too familiar with people. My sense of humor can be insensitive and off-putting. I do hug and kiss people casually.
When New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo announced his resignation last week, he could not help but to deliver a rather Cuomo-esque act of contrition. His speech was a journey. It began in the Borough of Acknowledgement.
The Attorney General did a report on complaints made against me by certain women for my conduct. The report said I sexually harassed 11 women. That was the headline people heard and saw and reacted to. The reaction was outrage. It should have been.
The very next stop, though, rejection.
However, it was also false.
The most serious allegations made against me had no credible factual basis in the report, Cuomo said, even as he steered toward what looked like self-awareness.
I said on national TV to a doctor wearing PPE and giving me a COVID nasal swab, you make that gown look good. I was joking. Obviously, otherwise I wouldn't have said it on national TV. But she found it disrespectful. I take full responsibility for my actions.
Cuomo apologized sincerely for specific alleged allegations toward a female New York State trooper. He'd been insensitive, disrespectful, made a mistake, plain and simple, he said. So from there, one would have thought the contrition train would have been headed towards the terminus of redemption or reconciliation. But Cuomo picked up speed and instead turned toward sanctimony.
If I could communicate the facts through the frenzy, New Yorkers would understand. I believe that. But when I took my oath as governor, then it changed. I became a fighter, but I became a fighter for you. And it is your best interest that I must serve. This situation, by its current trajectory, will generate months of political and legal controversy. That is what is going to happen. That is how the political wind is blowing.
And then Cuomo drove home, flashing a single-fingered New York salute to the state legislators who were then contemplating impeaching him. Cuomo cruised into his last stop, martyrdom.
Government really needs to function today. Government needs to perform. It is a matter of life and death, government operations. And wasting energy on distractions is the last thing that state government should be doing. And I cannot be the cause of that.
And with that, Andrew Cuomo resigned. But just days later, speaking to New York Magazine, he returned to his bristling default and claimed he was no martyr, that he would have won any impeachment against him and make the state legislature look like, quote, a ship of fools. So let me turn to Martha Nussbaum. Professor Nussbaum, what's the one thing that you think most characterizes the rise, fall, and perhaps rise again of Andrew Cuomo?
Oh, well, I've been laughing while I've been listening to these quotes because I live in Illinois where I don't have to pay constant attention to Andrew Cuomo. But look, there's great hypocrisy in this because when he alluded, and not in something that you quoted, but something else, to a line that's kept shifting, this man mm-hmm. has not been hiding underground for the last 30 years. The line, so called, started shifting in 1970. And with 1980, we got no means no. But then shortly after that, there was the demand for affirmative consent. So not just hearing a no is not enough. You need affirmative consent. And the criteria for sexual harassment have been really clearly laid out in the courts by 1990. unwelcomeness, pervasiveness, seriousness. And so he, you know, he reads the newspapers. He knows what's happening in the law. These are very high profile cases. So it's taken him like 30 years to begin to internalize what's actually been happening in the culture for a very long time. And to me, that's just rank hypocrisy.
Well, Martha Nussbaum is a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago and the law school there. I think more importantly, she's one of the most renowned philosophers working in America right now, author of many books, most recently, Citadels of Pride, Sexual Abuse, Accountability, and Reconciliation. And Professor Nussbaum, first of all, welcome to On Point. It's a real pleasure and honor to be able to speak with you.
Thank you, Magna. It's really nice of you to have me on.
Let me ask you, in other parts of Cuomo's speech, though, he talked about how, you know, he's been like this all his life. He hugs people. He kisses people. He's an Italian-American New Yorker. Is that a kind of self-awareness, though, that excuses his not recognizing, as you pointed out, how lines of acceptable behavior have been shifting?
Well, we've heard this often before. In my book, I talk about Plácido Domingo, who has, I think, much more effectively apologized later. But at first, what he says is, oh, I'm from Spain and the customs are different in Spain. But, you know, he's on notice for like at least the last 20 years that these ideas are shifting, and that especially when you're in a position of absolute power in a workplace, you don't do these things without asking first, may I hug you? And then if the woman says yes, that's one thing. I think it's still not a good idea in the workplace. It creates a phony kind of intimacy that can be exploited by the person in power. But in any case, every other workplace has rules about this. And of course, his workplace also is under the federal law. So he should know these things. And it's not enough to say, oh, I just wasn't aware. First of all, he should know the law. But second, he should be able to imagine how women feel when they're working in a workplace where a man has tremendous power over them. Of course, they're not going to say, please don't do that, Governor Cuomo, because they're afraid. And that's why we have laws about sexual harassment, where the fact that it's unwelcome is the criterion. You don't even have to protest and say no, but you just have to show somehow that it was unwelcome. Usually you show it by complaining to the higher up. So, but in this case, of course, there was no higher up. So it was very difficult for these women. And he should have been able to think into their head and have some empathy for their situation. And he should just not have done that.
So to be able to imagine, able to think into another person's state of mind when you're hugging them and kissing them as the governor of the state of New York. What prevents a person from being able to possess that kind of humanizing imagination?
Well, the vice that I call the vice of pride, I mean, this is really according to Christian tradition, the seven deadly sins and so on. It's not the kind of pride that the gay pride movement has, which is a kind of confident self-assertion. But the vice of pride is the vice that consists of thinking that you're above it all and no one else is fully real. In Dante's depiction of the proud in Purgatory, they're bent over like hoops where they can only see themselves, and therefore they can't look out and see any other person, and they don't acknowledge another person's reality. And that's a terrible thing. You could call it narcissism, but I think the term pride is fine, and it gets across what's going on here. People think that they're above others. Now, of course, I think all men in American society to some degree have had this vice because it's dinned into them that just by being men, they're above women. But there are different kinds of pride. Some people have class pride without having gender pride. Some people have race pride without having gender pride or class pride and so on. But gender pride is what consists in thinking that women are just objects that you can push around for your own use, and they're not fully real. And that means their autonomy isn't real. They don't get to say no. and their subjectivity isn't real. You don't get to imagine what life is like inside their heads. And he's a perfect example of this.
Mm. So you mentioned Dante and the fact that the prideful are doubled over, sort of regarding themselves, actually, with the weight of their pride on their backs. But they're in purgatory, which is interesting, right? They're not actually in hell. So we're going to come back to the purgatory hell differentiation here in a second. But I do wonder, you've written about so many different states of being, essentially, over your career. What was it about this particular form of pride, the almost narcissistic form of pride, that really drew you to analyzing it now at this moment in our culture?
Well, I got started on this book, Meghna, during the Kavanaugh hearings, because I thought so many things went wrong there. There was not a thorough inquiry. Her voice wasn't listened to, and all of those things. And I think there are lots of reasons to think that Kavanaugh lied about at least some things in his testimony, particularly when he said he didn't think that he had never heard that Alex Kaczynski committed any acts of sexual harassment. Well, gee, every law school in the whole country knew that Alex Kaczynski harassed his clerks, and our law school wouldn't even recommend clerks to his chambers for that reason. So, you know, to pretend see no evil the way he did was just not believable. So I thought a book should be written that fills people in on, first of all, how long this movement is. Some people think that we only began to notice these things with Me Too, but that's just not true. There are lots of unknown people, not famous Hollywood stars, who've been working in the trenches and talking about this. People, often African-Americans, have been very prominent in this movement and working to get the law to be better in both criminal law and civil law, and working to just get the public to be more aware of these things. So as I said before, by 1980 was the first case that established that no means no. That's the case that the movie The Accused with Jodie Foster was based on. Mm-hmm. Very interesting case where the woman was gang raped and people said, Nussbaum.
Yeah, so I'm sorry to interrupt you there. It's just that we're 5 seconds off of our break here, and I don't want to have to just stop you in the middle of that story, even though that's what I just did. So we're going to come back and hear the rest of it. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with one of the nation's preeminent philosophers, Martha Nussbaum. She's a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago, author of many books, and we're focusing on her latest, which is titled Citadels of Pride, Sexual Abuse, Accountability, and Reconciliation. And Professor Nussbaum, I actually will let you get back to that story of one of the earliest cases of sexual assault from 1980. I'll let you get back to that in a minute. But I actually think it's more, at this point in time, it's more important for us to sort of explore a little bit more about your view of pride through the eyes of philosophy. So let me get some clarifying questions out there. So first of all, you're distinguishing between pride as a sort of a momentary situational human emotion and as sort of a versus the pride as a fundamental character trait, are you not?
Absolutely, yes. The momentary emotion might lead in the direction of a character trait, but then again, it might not. So I'm thinking of it's a pattern of thought and feeling and behavior that I'm talking about.
Okay, a pattern then. And so, but then, as you said a little earlier, this pattern shows up in, you know, in different contexts. And so is it the pattern across all of those contexts that you're concerned about or condemning here?
Well, as I say, I think people can be proud in one area and not in another. And I think it's often the case that people may have gender pride without having race pride, or they may have class pride without having race pride or gender pride and so forth. So I'm talking particularly about gender pride, but I think we have to understand the overall thing. I mean, actually, Dante, whom I talk about, decided that he had professional pride. He was exalting himself above other poets, and he viewed himself as guilty of ignoring their contributions and putting them down and so forth. But he didn't think he had pride in the other areas. So we have to ask what area. But it's always a danger. Once you start thinking that you're above other people in one area, I think it can easily bleed into another area. And in our society, I think men have long been brought up to think that just in virtue of being men, they're above women. Of course, they are in terms of power. And therefore, they don't need to respect their autonomy, and they often speak over them and make decisions for them, and they don't have to respect their subjectivity. They think that they don't care about their feelings. And I do think that the prevalence of pornography has aided and abetted this, because they get this phony subjectivity of a woman who's just put there, either on paper or on film, to be there as the instrument of the man who always just wants whatever the man wants. And they get used to thinking that that's true in real life, that women are just there for them. They're just objects to be used.
And how does this, though, differentiate, or how is it different from other characteristics that are often applied to, you know, when people try to think through what the causes of pervasive sexual harassment or sexual assault are, in our current culture? Hubris, arrogance, that kind of thing. How is pride different from those?
Oh, I think hubris is a word the Greeks started using for what I call pride. I think it's very similar, except that hubris usually suggests that you think that you're above the gods. And so it has a religious connotation that I didn't particularly want. Arrogance, well, arrogance is part of pride, but there's something more fundamental about pride, which is you don't even acknowledge the full reality of other people. I've known many arrogant people who actually do respect other people and acknowledge their reality. So arrogance is not so great, but it isn't so global as pride. It isn't as deep. So I think pride goes to the very heart of the way a person sees the world. They look out there, and as Dante depicts it, they see only themselves. Now, as I say, that might not be true all the time. When they're with other men, they might see the other men, but they don't see the full reality of women. And I think that's really the problem. It's the question I was asking in the book is, what lies behind the pervasive objectification of women in our society, treating a person as like a thing, which involves treating them as instruments, not acknowledging their autonomy, not acknowledging their subjectivity? And what I concluded was, it's this vice, pride, which is a global trait that means you don't really take the reality of others seriously, that lies behind objectification. Because, of course, if you don't see them, if they're not real to you, it's natural you're going to use them like things.
And of course, though, the title of your book is Citadels of Pride. It's not it's not prideful individuals, right? It's these sort of impenetrable edifices that protect and even encourage the prideful. So what are these institutions? What are these citadels?
Okay, so the book is partly a story of the evolution of law, because I think pride depends on structure. Of course, education in your family is very important, but really law sends signals to everyone about what's good and what's bad, what's important and not important. It educates us all. And in the last 30, 40 years, the change in both criminal law and civil law, because sexual harassment is a civil offense, has changed the structure. The building now has a different shape, and you ought to know that you're in this kind of a building. But in some areas, the building has not changed. And there are different reasons in different areas, but the ones that I single out are the federal judiciary, college sports, and the performing arts. And they all have in common the fact that there is no stable structure of rules that protect the vulnerable and that educate the powerful. And the reason is different in different cases. The federal judiciary, because judges have unlimited power over their clerks, and the clerks used to be told that you can't tell anything about what goes on in the chambers. That's changed to some degree. The performing arts, because unlike most workplaces, unlike the workplace that I work in, you don't have a regular contract that goes over a long term. It's all gigs one at a time. And therefore, powerful figures in the whole field can have great power over you. Somebody like Harvey Weinstein, even if you're not working for him right at that moment. So you get these towering figures who can abuse everyone, even though they're not part of the same workplace at that time. And that's true of a lot of the music stars that I look into. I mean, I focus on classical music just because that's what I know most about. So I talk about James Levine. And I have to say the Boston Globe did wonderful reporting on the downfall and the prehistory of the downfall of James Levine, which educated me a lot. So anyway, James Levine is a case where he was just so towering in the music world that he could go on abusing young men. And notice that sexual abuse is an abuse of power. So it doesn't have to be only women. And I talk a lot about how the abuse extends to vulnerable young men. And no one could stop him, even if they weren't in the same orchestra. Now, of course, the orchestras always had weak rules. The unions were much too weak, and that's changing. But even if you were in a different place, you just thought, well, my career is going to take a blow if I offend James Levine. So it's the fact that the rules are porous, people move around, and there's no job security. And in the college sports, I think professional sports are more like my workplace. They have rules. If you violate them, you can be suspended or fired or whatever. And that's regularly happening. I think somewhat better in baseball than in football. Baseball and basketball have better rules. But in any case, it's happening. But in college sports, the problem is there are so few big stars. And there's this competition to the death. One former head of the NCAA called it an arms race to get these few talents and nurture them, because a lot of money is riding on this. So the TV contracts and therefore the income for these schools depends very much on coddling, first of all, recruiting and then coddling these star athletes. And therefore, if they commit crimes, whether it's theft or sexual assault, they don't want that to show up, because if they've been even charged with a crime, they can't play. So it's led to a terrible situation. It's like a no-win situation, where I've concluded after a long thinking and reading that it just can't be reformed short of ending Division I college football and basketball. And that's pretty much what the commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, who gave me a lot of help with the book, and I'm very grateful to him, what he's basically concluded too, that he's shifting over to a minor league system more like baseball. Baseball has always had minor leagues where you have a contract and you have rules and so on. And basketball is shifting in that direction. Football has not yet, because it's so expensive. No one has started minor leagues in football, and the colleges are footing the bill for these huge stadiums that seat 100,000 people and the equipment. And of course, that's how you recruit these athletes, by having glitzier facilities and so forth. But part of it is this built-in sexual corruption. There's academic corruption too, and that's a part of the story that I tell. But there's no way of really ending the corruption short of ending this arms race. And yeah. I think that's got to stop.
So, listeners, you are here listening to Martha Nussbaum saying it's time to do away with Division I sports in the United States.
Well, just football and basketball.
Just football and basketball. Okay. Point taken. But with all due respect, and I truly mean that because I deeply respect your career, I am going to just take a little bit of an exception to this, because Adam Silver, while, you know, the NBA commissioner, while he might have helped you extensively with this book, I'm going to question whether his motivation to turn Division I basketball into essentially a minor league farm system for the NBA is really out of his concern for the well-being of the vulnerable in Division I sports, and instead actually actually what he really wants to do is have even more control over the very system that gives him his stars who move on to the NBA. I'm a little dubious about Silver's motivation here.
Well, but look, he wants a way of nurturing talent that doesn't depend on the universities. And baseball has had that for a long time. Basketball has partly had it for a long time because Europe and other countries, I mean, a lot of stars come from Africa, from Europe, from Australia. Basketball is an international sport. But he just wants to sort of ramp that up a little by making the G League a genuine minor league that gives people an opportunity to learn. This is crucial because what the college system is supposed to do is give you career options. So if your athletic career fails, you know something and you can get a job. And the G League, his plan is to create learning academies alongside the G League where people will really learn stuff, where, of course, in Division I schools, they do not learn anything. There's a whole enterprise of cheating on their behalf and keeping them eligible and so on. And they just don't learn. So I think, you know, he wants to nurture talent in a different way, and that's perfectly possible. Baseball has done it for ages, and it can work.
But how would that – we're talking about pride and its impact on or it being one of the causative factors in your book on sexual harassment and sexual assault. So – this Division I conversation is absolutely fascinating. So I'm going to stick with it for another second here. Okay. How would, let's say Adam Silver got his wish and essentially the NBA got a minor league and there was no more March Madness in college basketball. I mean, how is that going to help shift the structure away from these citadels of pride and actually protect vulnerable people from sexual harassment and sexual assault? When, I mean, if we're talking about power, the power just shifts to the NBA. Yeah, but go ahead.
No, you have to, but in the NBA and in the Major League Baseball, and to some extent in the NFL, although the rules are weaker, you have genuine rules. You enter a workplace, the workplace puts you on notice that certain sorts of behavior, whether it's domestic violence or sexual assault, are forbidden, and then the penalties are spelled out. And there are a lot of people, and I talk about all the different penalties that baseball players have been given over the years. And so that is the first thing. These rules educate. If you're a bad apple, you still know that you're going to get punished if you transgress the rules, and you're under a contract. So it has a kind of stability built into it, and no one is going to coddle you because there are lots of people competing for a small number of positions. And if you are a bad apple, that's a strike against you. Whereas in the college, the competition is of a different sort because you have 150 schools competing for a very small talent pool. So the competition is of a different sort, and the players can exploit it to get away with assault and to get away with cheating in their courses and so forth. But so, yes, I mean, people will still have to be punished if they transgress the rules. But the other thing that ought to change is that the public should get used to the fact that these players suffer penalties. I think that has happened already in baseball, which is the sport I know best. You know, when Herman, the Yankees pitcher, was suspended for a long time in a way that really hurt the Yankees' pennant chances, well, you know, people accepted that. The evidence was clear, you know. So yeah. I think that's very important.
Okay, so strangely, this actually, in my mind, it brings us back to Andrew Cuomo, because you're making an argument for, you know, in college sports, in the performing arts, and in the legal system, the judiciary, right, with the judge clerk institution, that reforms of this actually shape of these institutions, of these citadels, could reduce the amount of sexual harassment or sexual assault even. But I wonder, I mean, as you were saying at the beginning of the show, Andrew Cuomo has been around for a long time. We have had laws on acceptable and unacceptable workplace behavior for decades. But he talked about, as you had mentioned, that it was only recently that he realized the line had shifted. So even with the addition of laws put in place or changes in structure to protect people, it didn't actually change his behavior until he was faced with the, you know, the total implosion of his political future.
Well, you know, he's an outlier. And in the academy, you see this too. And I've been around for a long time. I entered graduate school in 1969. So I saw a workplace where there were no rules. And over time, most men have been educated and they've modified their behavior. Maybe they even grew up differently because law has educated their families and they've grown up with different expectations. But now we still see sexual harassment going on, but usually it's a person of a somewhat pathological degree of pride. I won't mention academic names, but the people who are convicted today of sexual harassment are somewhat unusual in their psychology, and they're just extreme versions of what one might call inflated pride. And I think that's exactly what he is.
Well, we are talking this hour with philosopher Martha Nussbaum. Her new book is Citadels of Pride. Hop on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know what you think about Professor Nussbaum's view and definition of pride and how it influences or inflates or exacerbates sexual harassment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are listening to Martha Nussbaum. She's one of the nation's preeminent philosophers and a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. Her newest book is Citadels of Pride, Sexual Abuse, Accountability, and Reconciliation. Professor Nussbaum, you had hinted at this just before the break, but I was wondering if you'd be willing to share a little bit more of your experiences in academia, particularly at Harvard. When have you experienced sexual harassment in the workplace?
Yeah. Oh, well, I think everyone my age, and I'm 74, everyone, every woman my age and many men have experienced sexual harassment. When I got to Harvard, there were, of course, no rules. Well, there were virtually no tenured women on the faculty. There was only one tenured woman, and she was in a chair reserved for a woman. So, you know, basically zero. And that meant that men had all the power. I remember particularly that there were three bathrooms on the floor where I had my office, men, women, and faculty. But the faculty bathroom was another men's room. It was for male faculty. No woman on the faculty ever went in there. You just didn't do that. So men had all the power, including the power of restroom privacy. And there was, you know, a lot of sexual harassment. But the main thing I want to emphasize is because there were no rules, the good men didn't know what to do. And the women didn't know what to do. Now, Harvard was early. Henry Rozovsky, the economist, was dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Great hero in this area because he put in, after a survey of women at Harvard, he put in the first set of rules for sexual harassment and the first grievance procedure. So I think that was great. And I was one of the ones who took that survey. But before that, you just had nowhere to go. So my thesis advisor harassed all the women he worked with. He felt that it was incumbent on his masculinity to try out every woman. And one thing that was unusual about him was that he never retaliated when women said no. So that was made things a little bit better, but of course it still made the seminars and the workplace a terrible mess. It was corrupt and terrible. Actually, the women who said yes got it worse because he was an alcoholic and they had to try to get him into the classroom in the morning and so forth. But in any case, it was a terrible situation. We didn't have anywhere to go to complain. And there was one woman who just couldn't put up with this. She was going to complain anyway. So she went to the chair of the department, a very good man who would never have done anything like this. But he had no idea what to do. So he called in my thesis advisor, who has been dead a long time now, and said to him, you know, so-and-so has complained and you really shouldn't do this. Now that made it personal. It made it a personal humiliation from the chair to this guy. And therefore he went ballistic and penalized this woman at that point, when of course he hadn't penalized her before for saying no. But it shouldn't be personal. It's not personal. It should be a rule. And when you have rules in place, then we don't have to say, you've done something that I object to personally. We just say, well, here are the rules, and you transgressed the rules. So the rules take the burden off of the good man, who in this case had to personalize it. And this woman got a bad job. I mean, she got a job that wasn't terrible, but it was much less good than her work deserved, because the advisor didn't write her a strong letter, or maybe any letter. And to this day, I feel guilt because I did not complain. I didn't, because I just thought it was no point. And I guess I thought he's drinking himself to death, and I felt a little bit sorry for him anyway. Mm. But so that was my complex reaction. But in any case, you know, that was a bad situation. And when the rules started coming in, things changed right away.
Okay.
Powerful people were penalized.
Yeah. So let me ask you about that, because in hearing you describe the importance of rules and the fact that they allow a situation to be depersonalized, right, and put within the structure of what the rules allow and don't allow, that's actually quite a concrete and different approach than I think sometimes we've been hearing over, you know, the past several years in the Me Too movement, which at times has struck me as a little, a reckoning, but somewhat indeterminate. When I've on this show asked people, like, what specific change do you want? The answer is, people, we need to bear witness, we need to believe women, we need to hear stories, we need to aim for some kind of systemic transformation. So that's less concretely defined than what you're talking about, or am I reading this
wrong? Well, I guess it's a question of what kind of transformation. I want a transformation in which the rule of law plays a very important role, in which people don't get shamed out of their jobs, but they get due process and evidence is prominent and inquiry is prominent. And then in the end, if they've actually done something bad, they will be punished. But that's very different from what Me Too often does, which troubles me a lot, which is punishment by public shaming. Now, of course, that has a long history. We know about punishment by shame, the stocks, the pillory, and earlier the Romans used to brand people with a hot iron or tattoo them. But we know a lot about shame punishments, and we know that they're unreliable, that they migrate quickly from the people who've actually done something bad to people who are just ugly or unpopular. That's who the witches in Salem were, just unpopular women who just were targets for people's anger, and then they got shamed out of their lives often. And so it's not a good kind of punishment, and it asks the mob to punish the offender rather than a procedure governed by law and due process. Now, I'm a philosopher. I could have just stayed in the philosophy department. I went for a job that has me teaching partly in a law school because I like the rule of law. And I think there's something quite dignified and wonderful about the fact that a defendant gets respect. You get due process. And there's a specific burden of proof. It's a criminal offense. You have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. If it's a civil offense, there has to be a preponderance of the evidence, and so on. And, you know, there is a standard that's laid out, and people just don't suffer because the mob doesn't like them. And I think there's too much of this shaming in the Me Too movement. I do agree with you that telling stories is important because it's important for people to understand that this isn't just a one-time thing. It's very pervasive. In fact, I later wrote about my own sexual assault by a well-known actor. And the reason I wrote about that experience was that it was right after the Cosby indictment. And I wanted people to know this isn't just about Bill Cosby. It's a very pervasive fact of life. Here's my case. And then after I said that, then my sister wrote to me and said, you know, exactly the same thing happened to me. And this is when, of course, the Me Too floodgates open. It's good for people to know that. It's good for people to know that it's a vice that is ingrained in our society. It's not just one or two bad apples. But then what to do about it, I think process and law are crucial. That's why I liked what happened with Cuomo, because there actually was an inquiry.
So I just want to jump in here for a second, because you write specifically in the book about Me Too. You say our Me Too moment has seen its share of cases in which punishment has not been nuanced or calibrated, right? And then you talked about your concern about the mass shaming that takes place of procedural justice. And then, again, just your writing is just so sharp on this. I want to share it with listeners here, that you say this is also a time where some women not only ask for equal respect, but seem to take pleasure in retribution. Instead of a prophetic vision of justice and reconciliation, these women prefer an apocalyptic vision in which the former oppressor is brought low, and this vision parades as justice. No, justice is something very different, requiring nuances, distinctions, and forward-looking strategies to bring warring parties to the table of peace. Okay. I hear what you're saying there, but the idea of when it comes to sexual harassment, sexual assault, if we're bringing warring parties to the table here, first of all, that presupposes that they're warring parties of equal power. Whereas you said clearly and correctly earlier that this is about an imbalance of power that's inflated through pride. But more importantly, regarding pride, I am so taken by your analysis, you know, using Dante, that the prideful, they're doubled over. They can only see themselves. The weight of their pride narrows their scope of vision literally down to, you know, like their own torsos. And the very thing that bringing, that achieving reconciliation requires is the imagination and empathy that you said earlier the prideful do not have. So how do we get there?
Well, you know, I think deterrence is a large part of the story. Of course, it would be nice if all men grew up in families that gave them a good moral education and that they grew up with imagination. And many men do these days. I think most of the men I work with really understand these things very well. But there are always going to be some who do not have that kind of upbringing. And that's where law comes in. It informs and educates to some extent, but it also deters. So that if you want to act out of pride, but you know that you might lose your job if you do, then that deters you. And I'm all in favor of deterrence as a motive for criminal punishment. I'm not in favor of pure retribution, that is payback, because I think payback just doesn't give you anything. I mean, think about divorce. People fight to hurt the other one. Who's going to hurt the other one more? And it's a terrible spectacle, really. It inflicts great damage on the children, on the friends, but also on the parties themselves, because they become taken over by the spirit of revenge. Think of parents who've lost a child to murder. They become obsessed with the death penalty, as though that's going to give them something, might give them their child back. But of course, it never works. So I think retribution in general, and I've written a lot about this, is a futile exercise, and it never gives you what you want. And it's much better to look forward and think, what can we change about the future? And one thing we can surely do is to deter bad behavior by setting punishment at the right level.
So deterrence, though, is not reconciliation, right? I mean, by definition, it's not. So, but I keep wondering about what Andrew Cuomo reveals to us, and that is, even as he apologized, right, the very next sentence, oftentimes it was this like New York whiplash that you were getting. He would apologize and say that person was hurt, I apologize, or I'm sorry. And then he would say, but this is all about politics. We know what this is about. This is about taking me down. And that, you know, I'm stepping aside because that's what's the right thing to do for the people of New York, not necessarily the right thing to do for the women who alleged he harassed them. But also, like, I would have won if the state legislature had actually tried to impeach me. I would have made them look like fools. His pride never goes away. So I wonder, how can we create a legal structure to bring about reconciliation? Or are the structures that you're talking about better for the deterrence that you had mentioned?
Well, if the law has been improved in the ways I suggest, and part of it has happened and part of it has not happened yet, to take women's voices seriously, to do things like getting rid of the statute of limitations for rape complaints, making sure all rape kits are processed, all kinds of things that I suggest in the book, then women are positioned as equals of men, and that structure is fair. And then, of course, there are going to be outliers who really abuse the structure. Why they do that, that's a long story for each one. I don't know that any life story is ever completely finished. I think people's acts are not the sum of who they are, and possible that some of them will change. Who knows what you learn through great suffering. I do think that Plácido Domingo has really changed his attitude. There's a lot, I know a lot of people who work with him, and they do feel that he was one who could actually be reformed because he basically did respect women. He really just didn't understand. And so now that he understands a little bit more by suffering the loss of his engagements, now I think there's a possibility. That's what purgatory is. You did something really bad, but you're still in the game and you can still move on and change.
Exactly. I'm so glad you brought that up again, because as we talked about before, Dante puts the prideful in purgatory. He doesn't consign them irretrievably to hell, right? So there is the possibility of change. But I wonder if, are we as a society making that possibility more distant or more difficult to achieve? And I'm just going to fully acknowledge that Jack Beatty, our news analyst, our On Point news analyst, pointed me in this direction when he said that, you know, another one of the deadly sins is lust. And oftentimes he sees what is a prideful act that leads to sexual harassment or assault being recast in society as lust, and that, you know, boys will be boys. That was just locker room talk, you know, when Donald Trump talked about grabbing women. Jack wonders if lust gets a moral past, a moral pass, because he talked about how he once heard a woman excuse Jeffrey Toobin's conduct with, you know, what did you expect? He's a man. So are we making it more difficult when we mischaracterize what you see as pride as sort of a more excusable lust?
Well, I think, of course, that's old locker room talk. It's not today's locker room talk. And certainly in the workplaces that in the Major League Baseball and so on, you're not going to hear players talk the way that, let's say, Ted Williams used to talk, who really had terrible attitudes toward women. Things have changed. Now, not every single individual has changed, but the general nature of the discourse has really changed. Think about the New York State Legislature. Large number of those are men. I don't know how many, but I'm sure a majority. And, you know, they did this. They conducted the inquiry and they were going to impeach him. And so, you know, the numbers shift and somebody like Cuomo is more and more of an outlier. And it's the same in the university. People who are diehard sexual harassers are more and more outliers, whether they're hiding it in their minds and they're just deterred by fear of punishment or whether they've really changed, who knows. But things have changed. And I think that's the way to achieve reconciliation. Get a structure that positions the parties as people of equal respect. The rules apply to all equally. And then hope that the combination of that with a good education in families does the job.
Well, Martha Nussbaum is a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago and its law school, one of the nation's preeminent philosophers, and her book is Citadels of Pride, Sexual Abuse, Accountability, and Reconciliation. Professor Nussbaum, thank you so very much for being with us.
Okay, thanks so much, Meghna. It's a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.